coming to you not exactly live from...
The Cliffs of Insanity!
Don't open that! It's an alien planet! Is there air? You don't know!
That international man of geekery, that intrepid arch-geekologist, Indiana Jim.
You have chosen wisely.
Don't tell me you've never heard of me.
Have you ever heard of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates?
Yes.
Morons.
You, boy, are arrogant, hot-tempered, entirely too bold.
I like that. Reminds me of me.
And now, Indiana Jim.
Are you listening to this fellow? May I remind you, he's wearing a costume, not a uniform.
I have entertained in all the courts of Europe and speak a ready wit in their every tongue.
I told you I was famous.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Indiana Jim and the Writing Crusade. How is everyone? I don't know yet how many of you are listening, but I do thank those of you who are. This show is a recent addition to iTunes, so I hope to see some more subscribers join in the near future. I think that would be fun, don't you? Have a few more subscribers? I mean, that's kind of what you're looking for. When you do a podcast, is you're looking for people to subscribe to your show. And so here we are, and hopefully there you are. Well, what have I got in store for you today? Well, I have a few places I can go, but we're going to delve a little bit into news of the day just a bit. Publishers Weekly just issued their quarterly report, and it's illustrative of a decline in the publishing business. And every analyst, of course, is out there making hay, from Michael Shatskin to Hugh Howey, all the regulars. If you read the Passive Voice blog, all of those stories are aggregated there, and you've no doubt seen some of these posts. And I'm here to say, what do we make of it? And I just wanted to present a few pulls from these pieces and sort of get a big picture feel of what's going on and see what lessons we can learn from it. And the first, of course, is from the source piece from Publishers Weekly entitled "A Rough Month or a Rough 6 Months for Big Book Publishers." The most recent publisher to report results, Penguin Random House, said that the revenue at the trade publisher fell 10.7% in the first 6 months of 2016. To 1.52 billion euros, as measured in euros here, while the earnings before taxes or interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization fell 10.6% to 185 million euros. Whatever, that's all kind of big scale numbers here to me. The important thing to note is if you go to the report, everybody's reporting net losses, though Penguin Random House is the only one to report any in the double-digit percentages. Now, parent company Bertelsmann attributed the decline to the expected drop in ebook sales in the U.S. and U.K. due to changed retail terms, as well as the negative impact of currency exchanges. Partially offsetting those negative trends were steady physical book sales and gains in downloadable audio sales. In a letter to PRH employees, CEO Marcus Dole said another factor in the decline in results was the lack of a mega bestseller on the scale of The Girl on the Train and Grey, which helped drive revenue last year. He also pointed to a drop in ebook revenue as a reason for the sales decline, but noted that sales of digital audiobooks have had a significant upswing. And that leads us directly into Hugh Howey weighing in on the issue. He says, let's dispel a couple myths. The first is the idea that book sales are languishing because there hasn't been a breakout hit like (parentheses, whatever book sold well the previous year, close parentheses). I've been seeing this line trotted out for two decades whenever a publisher has a lull. Usually it's a single publisher explaining their performance in a quarter due to, quote, not having a hit like we had in insert book title here last quarter. Sound familiar? We just saw that. These days, it's the running excuse for the entire book trade, and it's absurd. Think about the number of damning things publishers are saying about themselves when they make this quarterly excuse. They are admitting that they can't create a bestseller, that none of their marketing and promotional tools actually work, that book sales are either all luck or completely dependent on the talents of the authors that they have historically abused. None of the promises a publisher makes to you can be kept. it's out of their hands. Whatever they tell you they'll do to make your manuscript a bestseller, they said to thousands of authors in the past year, and they have failed at all attempts. And that's kind of true. If you follow that logic all the way through, it means they are incapable of actually generating bestseller status for a book. It really is about the quality of the product. Probably the most damning evidence that publishers can no longer drive sales is the sad excuse for books that have kept them afloat. Last year, it was a rejected rough draft of To Kill a Mockingbird published against the wishes of the dying author. This year, it's a play not even wholly written by J.K. Rowling. And over the last 2 years, it has been coloring books, hiding the slide in actual physical book sales. None of these things are books. Publishers are no longer in the book trade. They are in the what the heck can we do to make a buck trade, and he didn't say heck. The irony here is that for years we've heard that major publishers are all about literature with a capital L, and Amazon is about diapers, and Google is about data, and Apple is about devices. The reality is that all of these companies are about profits, so their actions should be compared, not their motivations, which are largely the same. Their actions tell us about their philosophies as they pursue those profits. Philosophies pursue prop. That was kind of fun, but no, I don't want to do that again. Major publishers have colluded in order to screw the reader, have offered ever worsening book contracts to screw the writer, and have resisted innovation in an attempt to harm their top retail account. Higher prices, fewer rights to authors, and fewer sales channels have been where they've exerted their muscle. Ingrained biases and wishful thinking will continue to lead the way. A recent survey that showed more people prefer print books over ebooks will be taken as gospel when Amazon knows from their data that ebook readers read an order of magnitude more books than print book shoppers. So while publishers mold their business decisions around the people who read 2 books a year, Amazon will continue to cater to the readers who would consider this a slow weekend. It doesn't take a genius to sort out who is going to win market share when that sort of lunacy is taking place. And the title of that piece is You Can Expect Publishers to Make Pretty Much Every Mistake They're Capable of Making, in classic Hugh Howey style. We go to Bloomberg. Ebooks are not taking over the world. That seems pretty clear from a Pew Research Center survey released last week, which showed that the percentage of Americans who read digital books hasn't risen since 2014. The survey didn't show any real sign of a print resurgence either, though. Overall, the percentage of Americans consuming books in any form appears to be trending modestly downward. By holding steady, ebooks are thus gaining a bit of ground over print. This is not exactly the return-to-print story that the nation's book publishers have been telling lately. So you see where this is going. Hugh mentions that they love to say that print's coming back, and Bloomberg confirms this is not exactly the case. Yes, the Association of American Publishers reported in June that physical book sales were up in 2015, and that sales in brick-and-mortar bookstores rose too. The percentage of people who read books is down a little, but the people who do read books are buying more of them. That's what one should expect of a mature industry in an improving economy, which is certainly better than being in a rapidly declining industry like newspaper publishing. The AAP also reported, though, that ebook revenue was down 11.3% in 2015, and unit sales down 9.7%. That's where things get misleading. Yes, the established publishing companies that belong to the AAP are selling fewer ebooks. That does not mean fewer ebooks are being sold. Of the top 10 books on Amazon's Kindle bestseller list when I checked last week, only two, parentheses, The Light Between Oceans and The Girl on the Train, both mass-market reissues of novels that have just been made into movies, unparentheses, were the products of major publishers. So only two were from the major publishers. All the rest were genre novels, 6 romances and 2 thrillers, published either by the author or an in-house Amazon imprint. Their prices range from 99 cents to $4.99. The rise of ebooks fits Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen's classic model of disruptive innovation so perfectly that it seems unwise to assume that it is already all played out. This is from the introduction to Christensen's book, The Innovator's Dilemma. Quote, generally disruptive technologies underperform established products in mainstream markets, but they have other features that a few fringe, and generally new, customers value. Products based on disruptive technologies are typically cheaper, simpler, smaller, and frequently more convenient to use. Established companies naturally focus on serving their existing customers who aren't all that interested in the new product. They also look at the lower profit margins on the cheaper, simpler new product and think, no thanks. This leaves the field to new entrants who keep improving their product and luring new customers until it becomes dominant. The former industry leaders are left on the sidelines wondering what went wrong. And indeed, this is what we're seeing in this business. Now, there's a lot here, and I promise we'll get to a relevant point here at some point. That is from a Bloomberg piece, and I seem to be without the title of that Bloomberg piece, but you can, of course, go to The Passive Voice and find that, and I will have that in the show notes when I put the show up. You will already have that in the show notes by now. Lastly, from Mike Shatskin, and always listed as veteran publishing consultant, Mike Shatskin. Amazon doesn't need big publisher books to offer lots of pricing bargains to their Kindle shoppers. They have tens of thousands of indie published books, many of which are exclusive to them, and a growing number of Amazon published books that are offered at prices far below where the big houses price their offerings. That probably explains why Amazon can see its Kindle sales are rising, while publishers are universally reporting that their sales for digital texts, including Kindle, are falling. And this is from a piece entitled, "Ebook Pricing is a Lot Like Three-Dimensional Chess." High ebook prices, and high means, quote, high relative to lots of other ebooks available in the market, unquote, will only work with the consumer when the book is highly branded, meaning already a bestseller or by an author that is well known. And word of mouth, the mysterious phenomenon that every publisher counts on to make books big, is lubricated by low prices and seriously handicapped by high prices. If a friend says, read this, and the price is low, it can be an automatic purchase, not so much if the price makes you stop and think. An unpleasant underlying reality seems inescapable. Revenues for publishers and authors will be going down on a per-unit basis. This can most simply be attributed to the oldest law there is, the law of supply and demand. Digital change means a lot more book titles are available to any consumer to choose from at any time. Demand can't possibly rise as fast, and in fact, based on competition from other media through devices people carry with them every day, might even fall if it hasn't already. So publishers are facing one set of challenges with their high ebook prices. They'll create another set if they lower them. But unfortunately, lower them they almost certainly must. With more data, we may learn that developing new authors absolutely requires it, particularly in fiction. So, what are we to gather from all of this? Well, if you understand the long game, which is a discussion I'll be having on an upcoming episode, you'll know that the idea is that you build a lot of quality inventory as quickly as you can because you know you're building a base for passive income in the future. You're not beating to death one work of fiction, promoting the heck out of it, then wondering why you haven't seen your promised millions. Publishers and a lot of other businesses don't understand the long game. They work on a quarterly basis, and if they don't get that runaway hit, then we're on to the next thing. They're a bit like movie studios and TV networks that way. It reminds you of the concept of the spiral of death for mid-list authors that has been written about by Chris Rush and Dean Wesley Smith, where an author sells under the ordered amount of print titles, so the orders from the bookstores go down, revenue goes down, your ratings, if you will, go down, and you're out of a job, basically. Your show gets canceled. Your next movie script doesn't get picked up for a sequel, okay? This is all just continuing to track the downward trajectory of big New York publishing as a system. And to understand, as Hugh Howey said, how the actions of these companies illustrate their philosophies. Chris Rush is continuing to track how draconian publishing contracts are becoming. If you insist on having a traditional publisher as your gravy train, you have to become more and more willing to sell your future down the river. And more writers are going to be left with a bad taste in their mouths from the experience. And something else to note, and this has been coming for 10 years. I can remember Mike Stackpole a long time ago saying that if publishers will stop looking at New York City as the place where they absolutely have to be, they'll continue to pay outrageous New York rent prices. Their overhead will continue to be ridiculously high when it doesn't need to be. They don't have print shops in their basements. They outsource printing. So why the high value rent locations? What does that actually give them other than something ridiculous, which is prestige? It's all about being in New York because everybody's in New York. But New York is a terrible place for a lot of businesses to be, especially when you're having your industry being disrupted and you're trying to maximize as many profits as possible, but they're not going about it in the most sensible way. They're essentially going about it backwards. They're beating their heads against a wall, lamenting the new system, lamenting the disruption. They're still making buggy whips, to use a famous Stackpole analogy. They're still thinking they're in the buggy whip business when they should be looking at the transportation business. And if they would move operations westward to a place like, dare I say, Ohio, or places that don't charge arms and legs for your rent, if they move south or west a bit, they could really improve things, but they won't do that. How could they move to flyover country? I mean, just the thought of those elitist New York publishing types having to live in flyover country just is enough to make people puke, or, well, there's that bad taste in their mouths, so to speak. Then on top of this decline in publishing industry, if you insist on using agents, and Dean Wesley Smith has continued to kill that sacred cow, if you're willing to listen, that 15% for the life of the copyright is more and more obviously a stupid, stupid idea. I mean, let's think about it. You're inviting that agent and that agent's family or that agent's company to come live with you until 70 years after you die. No business arrangement is worth that. That's for the length of copyright. Unless, of course, you fight for a reasonable out-of-print or sunset clause. And that's certainly doable. But it's against most agents' best interest to do so. Unless they are extremely scrupulous and honorable people, and you don't know how scrupulous they're going to be unless you work with them for a very long time. Because their business model is not set up to restrict potential income. They know how to play the long game as well. And they want publishers and editors. They need publishers and editors to like them so that they get their client signed. Really, when it comes down to it, an agent needs publishers and editors to legitimize their business model more than they need writers, because writers are a dime a dozen. Writers are a dime a dozen. They're going to come along out of the woodwork. I mean, they probably don't have any shortage of writers submitting to them. There's still a lot of people believing in the old myths. So, but they definitely need publishers and editors, especially since publishers and editors are being bought and sold and moving companies constantly. They need that. So there is plenty of anecdotal evidence, though, to suggest that there are wonderfully scrupulous agents who value the relationships with their authors. But then it comes down to the question, what do they do for you that you and an intellectual properties attorney working for a flat fee can't do and save that 15% for the life of the contract? Think about what an agent does. And think of the places that you can go to learn how to do that. How do you think agents learn how to agent? You know, they intern for an agency. But there's also very experienced people who tell you what an agent does for you and can teach you to do that for yourself. So this is how more and more writers have gotten themselves deeply enmeshed in a system that is failing, and one I'm not terribly keen on joining. You know, the agent themselves, if they could write the books and be successful, don't you think they would be writing the books and being successful? You know, you get a lot of agents that try to be editors, that they're kind of the slush filter for the New York editor. But if they were good at writing books, wouldn't they be writing them themselves? When you take Lou Anders, a veteran editor, very, very good, but also a good writer. He knows his stuff. You know, I don't know if he ever was an agent. I guess he's always been an acquisitions editor, but you know, I don't know a whole lot about Lou's history, but there's somebody who can do both. You know, agents are usually people with an English degree. They don't have a law degree typically. So there are lots of ways that you could learn to do what an agent does and do that for yourself. And when it comes to negotiating rights in a contract, you hire an IP attorney that works for a flat fee. And you all have heard this. I'm not telling you anything surprising. This is all why it's imperative that you recognize the shift that has occurred. Thanks to the disruption of the publishing industry, understand how you, the writer, have been further empowered to take your future, your income, and your destiny into your own hands. Get educated. Read the people that are actually doing it. You think you can't make it as an indie? Read Hugh Howey, Joe Conrath, Barry Eisler, because all of them did it. You think you need to sign that bad publishing contract? Read Chris Rush. You think you need an agent to get a book into the hands of those New York editors? Read Dean Wesley Smith, because he's actually done it the way he writes about for decades. I mean, let that sink in. You will find that those people make an easy target for the people that are lamenting the disruption of the current system. But when you look at it, they all have the experience. They all have the practical experience of having done it. So you think about that just a little bit and start wondering about who you're listening to. Where are you getting your information? Where are you getting your opinions? Where are you getting your facts? Where is it all coming from? This is the thing. You do your own homework and you listen to the people who've actually done the things they're talking about. And for me, stay out of the system that is failing. Just as a rising tide lifts all boats, a decreasing tide lowers them all the same way. If you would like to give me some feedback, there are a number of ways to do that. You go to adventuresofindianajim.net, click on the logo for the Writing Crusade, click on the blog post for this episode, episode 7, click the leave a comment to the right there, and leave a comment. That's how you get in. And if you'd like to email the show, you can do so, writing@adventuresofindianajim.net. Twitter, I'm on Twitter, @IndianaJim, one word, and on various other social media platforms. And as usually, Indiana Jim or Indiana_Jim, or, you know, there's ways to find me. So really would love to hear from you. If you're listening, just a quick, hey, thanks for the show. I like it. Something simple like that. If you want to go find the listing in iTunes, you can do that as well. And leave a review there. Of course, reviews are always nice in iTunes so that when people are shopping for podcasts to listen to, they have something to base their search on. So anyway, thanks again, and I will talk to you next time.